A taste of Ireland with Discover Northern Ireland. Your next giant adventure is just a small step away. DiscoverNorthernIreland.com.
On Dublin's easy place to relax.
Sunshine 106.8. Sunshine 106.8.
Hi, I'm Ed Finn, and you're very welcome to A Taste of Ireland. My special guest this evening is one of the most recognisable faces of Ireland's hospitality industry. Proprietor of 7 restaurants in Belfast, he shares the credit for transforming the city's food culture and holds the record for the longest lived of Northern Ireland's Michelin stars, with a total of 19 Michelin stars awarded to date. Michael Dean, you are very welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much.
I'm exhausted reading all that out. Yeah,
seems,
oh my God.
Seems like a long time ago.
You're the godfather of the Belfast food scene. Unbelievable stuff.
Yeah.
Come here, Michael. We're in unprecedented times at the moment. It's a really difficult time to be in the food and hospitality business. How are things going?
Well, I can't say it's all roses, to be honest. It's pretty bleak out there. The picture is what it is. We have to try to make our best of a bad situation. We've built up over the years a very serious, heavy-hitting business in Belfast, and we've built it up from nothing. And it's more or less all closed down now, and we've probably got to wait on a vaccine. We've got to hope for the best. But no, it's not a pretty picture. There's no point in me telling you likewise. They've said we're allowed to do takeaways and deliveries, but at the end of the day, it's just keeping staff active and keeping a few pounds rolling in, and we just have to wait and see.
Yeah, of course. Very, very challenging times. Michael, if I could just bring you back, your story is fascinating. Going back to, I suppose, where you got your love of food and where it all started. Could you, I suppose, bring us a little bit along?
Yeah, I'll always go back to where did I first find this love of food. I didn't really have a love of food when I was a teenager. I wanted out of school. I definitely needed out of school. I hated it. Everybody wearing the same uniform, had long hair. I knew I was different. I was either cut hair or cook. And I thought cooking would be the easier option, when it turned out that it hasn't been. But I left school very early. I did a catering course in Bangor Tech, and the rest is history. But no, I didn't love food. I wasn't one of those persons who was tied to their mother's apron strings, making casseroles and doing this. I just wanted something easy. And when I started working in the Imperial Hotel in Donaghadee, my first job, I thought opening boxes of Black Forest gatto and deep frying orange bread crumbs, fillets of bread, I thought that was cooking. I thought that was easy. And it wasn't until I started to read and study and look what was happening abroad or in London that I wasn't really doing the right thing.
And of course, London, that was the place to go in those days, was it?
London was the place to go, but probably the centre of the world for food after Paris in those days. But what I sort of forgot, that I was a guy with long black hair from Belfast, and the troubles were quite bad then. You know, anybody in Ireland was, from any part of Ireland, was finding it difficult, and I worked very hard and long into the night trying to change my accent. And, you know, and I look back now and look at the way certain, you know, over Black Lives Matter and this and that. The Irish had a hard time in the 70s and the 80s, even though I made a lot of friends there. And the England was my second home, and I fell in love with it. But not every day was easy.
And you started your career in Claridge's in London.
Yeah, well, I started just before that, actually. I mean, I started in Claridge's. Used to have this thing called a pull, which you queued up every day to get a ticket to go and sort of wash pots and wherever they sort of needed you. It was like a line of kitchen porters, because nobody would really give me a job, first and foremost. I started in Claridge's, washing up, doing this, doing that, picking up the odd thing. Started to learn how to hold a knife, doing blah, 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 because I'd only get basic cookery skills. And I took it from there, and I worked hard, and I decided when I went there that I was going to absolutely take anything, take any amount of abuse, take whatever was thrown at me. And there's a lot of Irish guys who did very well in London. I mean, you mentioned the likes of Paul Flynn and that, who worked himself up and became Nico Landennis's head chef and that. So some of us did very well, but we probably had to work twice as hard as anybody else.
Yeah, of course. I mean, at that time, as you said, London was, I suppose, really a kind of a melting pot, but also it was a real place to go and learn your trade.
And the thing was, you know, you had people like Albaru, and I eventually got to work for Musselman in Dorchester, but it wasn't just the Irish couldn't cook, the British couldn't cook in general, we were told. So we had to hold on tight. And, you know, when I look back now, food has transformed so much. And there's a lot of boys that come through my patch have gone on to do better things. A lot of guys are still with me. And I love food. I love restaurants. I love people. And to see the blame that's sort of pointed at hospitality at the moment, it hurts me greatly, because I still think we're seen as a profession, a very healthy profession. I think when we're compared to pubs and pubs that step out of line, etc., it makes me feel very angry. But we are what we are, and we just have to keep going.
Yeah, of course. I mean, it seems like sometimes you think people are burning fields to kill weeds, Michael, but you know, it's all about keeping people safe, I suppose, he says. But it's a lot of people talk about food as if it's a gastropub compared to a Michelin star restaurant, but you know, you can't compare them.
You can't, and it's very, very difficult. And I really hate the way it's been pitched at the moment. We've asked for data day in, day out. And, you know, I'm not even going to start on what we've lost through this pandemic, but like it's well over £1 million what we've lost in turnover. To open up again was at least £50,000 or £60,000. And for the chief medical officer to tell us we were doing absolutely superb, and then the next week tell us to close. And my staff just completely disheartened, looking at the floor. They didn't buy into being security guards. And, you know, a table of five come in and they're from three different families. They have to sit in three different tables. They're probably just better to say, look, guys, go home until this is all sorted and we'll welcome you back. But meanwhile, the rent stack up, the bank loans stack up, you know, there's a whole enormous pile of work that needs to be climbed. And let's hope we can keep our health and our sanity to be able to do that.
No, absolutely. And I suppose that's why the whole government support thing has to be really strong. And, you know, it is a very difficult time. Are you gearing up for Christmas now? I suppose you are.
Well, the way we're looking at it, Christmas would be our big month. We would do more business in the last quarter of the year than any time. But how do you do the private parties? There's no rule book. How do you do the businesses that used to come out for 20, 30 guys, having a few pints, a few bottles of wine, some food? We have to sort out in some way how we do this, and we haven't been told. I mean, the rule books, you know, rule of six, you know, three families, 2 meter distance. Yeah, well, all respected the rules, and we'll guide ourselves through it the best way we can. But very difficult. This is going to be a very, very difficult Christmas. If we get open.
Fingers crossed, yeah, right? Fingers crossed. Yeah. We all need a good Christmas, Michael, I can tell you. When you came back to Belfast from London, I mean, it must have been a different world completely compared to what we have today.
Well, I thought it was, you know, and I took a head chef job in Belfast Castle, but I still did six weddings on a Saturday and three on a Friday, and I had a little restaurant up the stairs, and I got a couple of boys together who wanted to try to teach them what I learned in my travels. And yeah, it was good. But the biggest compliment, but also the biggest nightmare, Paul Rankin was already here. Paul Rankin had bought the Arabian Nights at the bottom end of the Donegal Pass and opened this restaurant called Roscoff. It was a restaurant that was closed by Environmental Health. And he spent a few pounds on it, put a few curtains up. Him and his lovely wife, Jeannie, went in and they were cooking probably some of the best food that Ireland has ever seen. And so I was well pitched at the number two behind Rankin. And that's the way it was. We had to live and learn. But Paul gave a lot to the food scene, as I think I have, and Robbie Miller as well, God bless him. And we can set the ball rolling for the guys that are there now. I'm lucky enough still to be here, somewhere at the top end with my own teams. And, you know, I'm thankful for that.
And, I mean, Roscoff, I remember having very good confy of duck there one time.
Oh, yeah,
it was great.
Yeah.
And I met Paul in the loo, who was class.
Yeah.
Very nice fella. The feeling you must have had, or the sense of achievement when you got your first Michelin star, can you tell us what that was like?
Yeah, well, we're the only one in Ireland, I think, in 97. And I'd actually moved out to Helens Bay, and we'd had the restaurant 2 or 3 years. And the year before that, actually, the Michelin Guide had phoned me to find out something about a glass of wine or whatever, blah, blah, blah. And we'd heard there was a star in the north. We'd heard there was only one in Ireland, actually. that year, but it happened to be Robbie Miller in Shanks. So I was sort of, oh God, what am I going to do? Robbie Miller's got a star before me. So what I actually did was I got my head down. I didn't leave Dean's in the Square for a whole year. I slept on a settee. I washed her. I chopped her. I cooked her. And I was really quite difficult with my brigade and my staff to try to reach the standard because I knew it was in me and I believed it was in me. And I got there. I eventually got there. Next year, we were the only Michelin star restaurant in Ireland. It was absolutely unbelievable. I did enjoy it, but my father had a heart attack. My mother had a nervous breakdown a few weeks before that, and I was going from one home to the other, trying to look after my parents as well. So I probably didn't get the full enjoyment out of it.
You went on, of course, then through four different venues that you had. You got 19 stars over the years.
Yeah, we moved to Belfast then the next year because I felt I was big enough to take on the world, so to speak. I never wanted to be the best chef in the world, but I wanted to do good in business. I love the industry. I'm willing to work 24 hours a day at it. And we bought a restaurant in Hart Street, and the troubles were still here. The security was still high in Hart Street where it is now. But it was just, we opened the one restaurant. It was a brasserie upstairs, and the restaurant Michael Dean upstairs, brasserie downstairs, and we took it from there, and we just started to expand and borrow loads of money and pay back loads of debt and try to change the food scene in the city, not just at the high end, but at, you know, everything from a breakfast to a sandwich to the Star, which is still there today.
I remember when you had your year of food and drink up here. Yeah. I remember having the most amazing meal in your place, and there was a famous celebrity or two in there as well. It was one of the best nights I could remember up here in Belfast.
We've been lucky that we've been able to guide the celebrities into Dean's, and we've had hundreds over the years. And I've always enjoyed their company. I've always made myself aware that they were in. I've always introduced myself to them, and that hasn't always been pretty. There's been a few bits of back chat and told where to go, but that's the restaurant bit.
Yeah, and of course Belfast, everything that's happened over the last few years, I mean, with the filming scene here, as you said, Titanic, Game of Thrones, for example, amazing the amount of people that you meet here now from Japan, Argentina. They're here for, you know, to see where Jon Snow patted the dragon on the head.
I know. It brings a tear to me. The big guy from Game of Thrones, when he got off the plane in America, and we've got this on Rebound where it says, what do you miss most about Belfast? And he says, Deans. I used to go and eat 100 oysters sort of every Friday night. I'm sure he won't mind me saying that, but Game of Thrones, fantastic for Belfast. Absolutely fantastic.
100, he'd be pretty frisky on the plane home, I'd say. Brilliant. Michael, that brings us nicely along to your first choice of music this evening. Bruce Springsteen, If I Should Fall Behind.
Yeah, it's a song I probably dedicate to my wife, who's the backbone of the business, who used to be in the media, who takes it silently in the background, which helps me every day. And she probably doesn't get enough credit. And we sort of, she's a big Springsteen fan, always has been. I never was really. I was more of a sort of Dylan fan. But when you hear this song, it relates very much to the business, and if one of us does fall behind, how do you keep it going? How do you keep everything going? And it's just a song that sort of, I first heard Faith Hill actually singing it, which was absolutely brilliant as well. But and when we heard Springsteen, it just unbelievable piece of music.
We said we'd walk together.
A Taste of Ireland with Discover Northern Ireland. Your next giant adventure is just a small step away. DiscoverNorthernIreland.com.
On Dublin's easy place to relax.
Sunshine 106.8. Sunshine 106.8.
You're listening to A Taste of Ireland, and my special guest this evening is Michael Dean. Michael, a lot of people would be stressed out running one business. With your seven restaurants now, being a chef is one thing, I suppose, and you were talking about this before, but running a restaurant, it's a completely different ballgame, really, isn't it?
Well, you know, to me, I would be bored if we just had one. A lot of people find it troublesome with one. I tend to go in the front door and out the back door and then on the next one. We're very lucky that we have three in our private dining room in the one building. How we ever got to be that big in Hart Street, I don't know. And then our other two are Vin Cafe and Dean's Deli around the back, so they're only 100 yards away. Then we have a massive restaurant at Dean's at Queens, which is about 20 minutes drive. So it's about me putting good building blocks in, good management, good cooks, good chefs who are, if they're not as good as me, they need to be better than me. And, you know, we try to look after them and meet with them and talk with them. And we are food driven. It's a food driven business. And I think that's what sets us apart from quite a lot. And I don't know if I ever wanted to have 7 restaurants. I don't know if I wanted to have 10. And, you know, the bank make the windows that small. Sometimes you can't get back out. And that's just where we are. And I enjoy it. I love it. It's in my blood. Every day is the same until where we are now.
And I suppose that is kind of the secret of success for yourself, I suppose, as well, to surround yourself with some great chefs and have really good people working with you.
Well, as you get older, you know, you're not going to be playing in a premiership when I'm not that far off 60 years old now. And if I am in the kitchens, which I am quite a lot, and things change in food, people change in food, and I can tell if I am cooking with the boys, I can see them looking at me sideways, kind of not moving a bit quicker, or that I really do that, or would I hurry up. And I have a good rapport with all the guys, and they like to see me in there, especially some of the very young ones. So, you know, in the words of Thomas Keller, if we don't make the next generation of chefs better, then we have definitely failed. And I've tried to do that with a lot of my good guys out there. And if you look at Alex Green, who just won Great British Menu, he's a head chef in Epic. He's contained a star, a great media presence. It's up to me to try to give those people and the chances that probably I didn't have. And that's very important. And sometimes they move on and you've got to rebuild. And that's it.
Mentoring is something that's so important. And for yourself, I mean, was there anyone special that you can remember sort of was your sort of mentor?
Well, I think when I actually got the job in the Dorchester, when I approached Anton Mosman in the toilets of the Shelbourne Hotel, which sounds a bit strange, and asked for a job, because the queue to get into the Dorchester Hotel then was about 4 years. And I decided just to brass neck it, and I sort of begged for a job. And it's just over 20 years old to go in there as a sort of fourth commie was quite old. But, you know, I like Mosman, and there's a few English people along the way, people like Ian McAndrew, Patrick McDonald, who had great influence on me, put their arms around me because I was Irish. There was a guy from Dublin called Rory Morahan, who was the Druid chef. I don't know if you've ever come across him, but he protected me from the situations in the likes of Dorchester. So there's a lot of people out there who have helped me along the way, and I try to stay in touch with most of them, but I was a busy man.
For you as well, I suppose, nowadays, I mean, managing the chefs, because, you know, the way the quintessential idea of chefs being unhealthy and snacking and, like, running around throwing knives around the kitchen, that idea has kind of gone a long time, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that mindset has a bit of changed a bit. You know, a lot of our guys would definitely eat healthier, they would go to the gym, they would try to go to bed early. And I think that sort of mindset has gone. Not many people would shout in the kitchen as much as they used to. But I remember I used to shout up a bit. But no, the temperament has to be different, and we have to treat people better with a bit more respect. Very rarely anybody would do over a sort of 40-hour week, whereas in my days it could have been close to 100. And that's just the way the business is now, and we have to follow the business guidelines. And I'm just glad we're still in it.
You'd be recognised, Michael, as one of the people that developed the whole food scene here in the north, and in Belfast in particular, I suppose. What was that like? I mean, what influenced her? What did you want to see happening over the last number of years?
Well, you know, I first wanted the star. It was all I wanted, nothing else. And I was hungry for that. But then when I started to look around and think about it, I think it needed to be more. I wanted to do good breakfasts. I love good bistros. I love large brasseries. I've been in the places all around the world and that. So the food culture was always changing. And now when I look around and I see there's people making great pizza, there's great ethnic restaurants, there's people making great kebabs, the Belfast food changed. And if I helped to do that, that's absolutely wonderful. You know, great Chinese cooking. And the whole culture of the food scene in Northern Ireland has changed really without anybody's help.
It's quite an achievement. I mean, when you think about Belfast today compared to, I suppose, Belfast 15 years ago, I mean, it's quite incredible what has happened, isn't it, the transformation?
Yeah, I mean, and you look at restaurants all over the UK, and we can compete with anywhere at the level of one star, definitely. And you know, cities like Glasgow, I don't even think have a Michelin star. I mean, there's a few in Edinburgh here and there. But no, the guys have taken the ball in Northern Ireland, and they've ran with it. And I think Belfast has got a great scene at star level. I think we're still missing a little bit in the ethnic sort of community, and there's a lot of people are doing the same sort of style of food. I think we have to differentiate yourself a bit, but well, we keep going.
Is it difficult to keep it fresh? I mean, obviously to keep the passion going, to keep, you know, the excitement and the enthusiasm.
That's a difficulty that there is. And I think when you're under so much financial pressure, the creativity round the food end sort of goes out the window to a certain degree, and you're worried about every penny. You're looking in the bins, you're doing this, you're doing this. So the people that you employ, you have to, okay, we need to make money, you need to get a food percentage, you need to do this. Our executive chef, Chris Fernan, is very, very good at that, at portraying that out to the people. But they're the people that have the creativity, that you have to take the worry of finance away from them and let them be creative. If it doesn't work and loads of load of money, well, then that's a different problem. But in general, we're being as creative as we can be at this certain time.
Travelling is a brilliant way as well, going around the world and seeing all the different influences and then probably bringing some of the ideas back.
I don't think you should ever take travel away from anybody. I think travelling is absolutely wonderful. I've travelled quite extensively, mainly Thailand, Europe. Never a big fan of America. I've only been a couple of times, but travel is key. Ingredients are key. People are key.
When you have the amount of Michelin stars that you have, right, is it very, very difficult to maintain that?
It's difficult, but I mean, our Michelin star restaurant, it's got 8 or 10 tables. That's all it does. It doesn't do any resets, doesn't do any shortcuts, so to speak. The staff who are there work there. They're dedicated to work there. They're open the same hours or close the same hours. They don't have somebody making a sauce one day, somebody doing it the next day. So it's not rocket science, but it's consistency and keeping a consistency there. And that's the way it's always been, even though food has changed, the methods have changed, the whole culture of Michelin dining has changed. And I say we've been there a long time. We know how to work the formulas. There is a formula. Michelin will tell you there's not, but there is a formula to get a Michelin star. And I'm really pleased that we have people still wanting to work at that level. If I didn't have people wanting to work at that level, I probably would no longer have the star in the camp, and that's to be honest.
It's an amazing achievement. I mean, I know people that actually just come up to Belfast just to go for lunch and dinner in your place because they just absolutely love the whole atmosphere and the whole... It's not just about the food, is it?
No, it's... You know, I used to think that, but you're right, you know, and I would work hard on this. It's about the decor, and my wife would work hard on the decor with our design people. It's about the music and the acoustics and about the whole feel-good factor. And if you look at our restaurant, Love Fish, it's somewhere that I want people to feel if they were going on their holidays or they've been in their holidays. It's not a bar, it's not a restaurant, but it's relaxed. I mean, it's keeping the detail right all of the time, not just on a Monday and a Wednesday, but all of the time. And I would find that that's probably the most difficult thing.
And the variety of restaurants that you have, can you just tell us, because there's a lot of diversity across the restaurants.
Yeah, well, when we had Dean's originally in Belfast, and that's what it was called, Dean's, and it had a restaurant, Michael Dean, then there was a very quite up and trendy gift shop called Equinox beside us, and then it closed because TK Maxx and internet had taken over. And so we decided to take the premises on my accountant's advice that if you don't take it, somebody else will take it. So then we decided then to diversify what they would do with it. So we put 3 restaurants in it. We have one called Meat Locker, which is Asador grilled meat, great chips, great sauce. Love Fish, which does simple dishes from around the world. It's simply cooked. And then have Epic, which is the badge Michelin star restaurant. So I was a bit worried that it wasn't going to be a bit like Disney World, that you walked in the front door and you had to buy a ticket to see which one you went to first. And within that, we used to have a dine around Dean's, which was a bus tour, which went round all the restaurants on a Friday evening, and you bought a ticket and had something to eat in all of them. But sadly, that's been put back in the bus station.
On hold for a while.
Yeah.
Michael, that brings us very nicely along to your second piece of music this evening. A really nice piece of music. Dawes Band, A Little Bit of Everything.
Yeah, I've been listening to Taylor Goldsmith so much through the lockdown. Married Mandy Moore, very famous actress and singer last year. I think he's worked on Bob Dylan in the Basement Tapes with Elvis Costello. It's just his voice and the meaning in his music. And just listening to A Little Bit of Everything is from three different people, different opinion about what A Little Bit of Everything is. And I think he's just a superb poet, and long may he go on.
Taste of Ireland with Discover Northern Ireland. Your next giant adventure is just a small step away. DiscoverNorthernIreland.com.
On Dublin's easy place to relax.
Sunshine 106.8. Sunshine 106.8.
Hi, you're listening to A Taste of Ireland, and my very special guest this evening is the godfather of the Belfast food scene, Michael Dean. Michael, how do you balance business and your family life?
Difficult. Very, very difficult. I mean, my wife Kate, since she retired from journalism in front of UTV, and she had to bring up our son more or less single-handedly by herself, who's now 20. Very fine young man he is. But it's finding the balance, and it's very, very difficult. We both work very, very hard in a business, but it's just setting time apart from holidays, setting time apart from maybe a Sunday, and we do not have the same family life as most people would have, but it's definitely very, very different. Mark Orson was brought up, and he's called after Mark O'Pierre White, by the way, brought up in the industry, eats in the restaurant, goes to the restaurant, does a bit around the restaurant. So we're all about the restaurant, and I think that's what makes Dean's a bit different than anybody else. The name is on the door, the people are in the building, the people are doing the work, the people are doing the PR, the people are cooking the food, and otherwise I'd never have put my name on it if I was never going to be in there every day.
The hands-on approach, I think, is really what makes it such a success as well. Have you noticed, with the sort of restriction on international travel, etc., a lot of people that hadn't been up before really discovered Belfast? Have you seen that yourself firsthand?
I think the people from south have always, I think, supported us. And people come up on the train, have a glass of champagne on the train, maybe eat in the restaurant three times in a row, maybe go round all the restaurants. And, you know, there's definitely got a lot of more kick out of the people from the south. They're definitely more want to party people. They always have been that way. I enjoy having them in the restaurant. And I mean, Ireland, probably through all this, should maybe have a joined up approach in everything. The people in Ireland, and I'm not into politics in any way, but we do live in one island, and I just love to see them, and I love to go down south. There's bits of Ireland I've never been to, mainly because of the weather, but I love the restaurant scene in Ireland. I have great friends in Dublin and beyond, and I think, you know, if there's anything good to come out of this terrible virus we have, that the people in Ireland maybe get to know each other a bit better and share each other's humour, share each other's food.
In terms of running a restaurant, what is the secret formula? Is there something that just works for you?
It's collective decisions underneath the flag of the badge, which is Dean's. And I've been glad to be a part of it, because it's not just me. There's many of us that form Dean's. But we're lucky we don't have any mass backers. We've got no investors to answer to, because investors can be difficult when they want their money back very quickly. So there's only myself and Kate in the business with the bank, and then our management team on the second tier, and good advice, have good accountants, have an accountant inside, accountant outside. And, you know, at the end of the day, it has to make money. And over the years, that's one thing I've learned, that a lot of chefs don't know how to make money. They never have made money. And by the time they get to what age I would be now, they're well and truly on a scrap heap. So it's important to encourage the business side of things.
The failure rate is quite high when you look at the statistics of chefs that open restaurants.
Yeah, I think the failure rate out of restaurants, with Danske Bank figures, is 12 out of 13. You know, I think to go into the bank now and say you want to open a restaurant, most of them will just laugh at you unless you've got a really proven track record at it. And I can understand that, you know, trying to teach people about VAT, about margins, about costs, about hygiene. And this goes back to the same point that, you know, we don't want to be having battles with the medical profession. You know, because we are a profession as well, and try not to sweep us under the carpet as if we're there's a criminal aspect about this, to take us seriously. And if I really thought for one moment that the virus spread in my restaurant, I would give the keys back to the landlord, quite clearly.
I mean, and the precautions that have been put in place, I think, have been so good. And I mean, and the rates, I mean, you're talking about, you know, show statistics earlier. I mean, the rates are really, really low.
Well, I think asking for the data again, 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 that we've seen that that doesn't really spread in a hospitality venue, or especially a restaurant venue. And schools and churches and supermarkets, well, people are not following the proper guidelines. And I think we need some sort of relief from this and some sort of break from it, that we're not seen to be the cowboys, the bogeymen in this. And the rates are low, and you know, please tell us what we're doing wrong. Please tell us what we've got to do to make it better. We'd like to have the doctors in for dinner. A lot of the NHS staff would come into our restaurant and say, oh, I hope we're not going to be closed again. What are we going to do? Where are we going to go? And where's the taxpayers going to come from to prop the NHS up, which is already on its knees? And that's not through the fault of hospitality. That's through the fault there hasn't been enough money. And we're now being kicked around the city as if we're to take some sort of blame. And I won't stand for that, but it's very, very difficult for me to go on with Stephen Noland or William Crawley and say, look, we're not the guilty party. And because the gun's going to be pointed at you all the time. It's, you know, hospitality now against schools. And, you know, Michael McBride stood in the restaurant and he said, what a wonderful job we're doing. This is absolutely super. Look at the social distancing. Look at the machines you have for people to sanitise with. Look at the way you've changed everything about this business. We've taken half the seats out. We've done this, with whatever. And then all of a sudden, 2 weeks are closed. Close down.
Yeah, I mean, it's soul destroying, really, isn't it? It really is. I mean, it's so difficult. I mean, to get up in the morning and keep going with that sort of, you know, what doesn't make sense.
Yeah, but we've been through a lot, you know. We've been through a lot. This has probably been one of the worst. People always say to me, you know, what's been the worst? So we went through flags. We went through troubles. We through putting windows back in every Friday afternoon when it had been blown out. So we've been through a lot. We're experienced. We've been able to take the damage. And we'll keep fighting on until there's some type of antidote for this, or some type of understanding that you cannot destroy an economy. You can't do it. We're going to have to live with it in some sort of way. And I haven't got that answer. I really wish I did.
Of course. I mean, hopefully Santa Claus is going to bring us a vaccine for Christmas anyway, because that's what I'm hearing. But, you know, it would be great, because, you know, hopefully it'll make life easier for everybody then.
Well, you know, I think people will treat restaurants differently then, when this all goes away, that people will have maybe a bit more respect for the core people that work in restaurants, for people who are waitresses, for people who are kitchen porters, that it's not an industry which should be treated like that. And if people come out, maybe they'll start to say thank you to hospitality staff, or maybe that just the gestures will be different, the complaints will be different, and maybe we'll fill a full place with a bit more love for hospitality.
Just for Christmas coming up, what do you love to do yourself? What's your favourite Christmas food?
Well, my wife insists on turkey all the time. I'm not the biggest lover of turkey and ham, I never have been. But, you know, do your shopping well. You know, make a list before you do it. Buy properly. Try to buy as local as you can, and fresh. And, you know, always probably base your shopping around what the protein is, you know, if it's beef or if it's turkey, if it's chicken, and work out what goes with that. You know, what would you see as a starter would go with that? Obviously, it should maybe be fish or vegetarian. Try to work around the seasons, what's seasonal, and or else you're going to pay way out of price. You know, you see people lifting asparagus off the shelves and the wrong time of year, and they're from Chile or Timbuktu or somewhere, and it tastes like whatever. So try to shop seasonal, shop sensible, and try to get it on the price, and try to get something that everybody wants. And if you're going to buy a cookbook, make sure it's simple, make sure the recipes work. It doesn't always turn out the way the recipe says.
Yeah, I know. Especially some of those American cookbooks, I find. Yeah, the different names on vegetables and everything. You don't know what you're cooking.
Shocking.
Yeah. What is your own, I mean, if you're sitting at home, Michael, and you're watching a bit of TV and you're relaxing, what is your guilty pleasure yourself?
Apart from Portuguese vino verde, my guilty pleasure vino would be, my favourite meal in the world is probably steak and chips and Bernese sauce. Or a really well-made green, red Thai curry type of thing if you don't get it on the furniture. But just something very, very simple. And, you know, some food chains and some supermarkets and stuff now, they've caught us up a bit. You know, some of the development chefs in there are cooking some, not that I do it, but some people would say, have you seen this in such and such a store? And that makes us have to raise the bar again, because we have to cook better than what you get in the supermarket. We have to do that. And some restaurants obviously don't, and this is going to be a problem. And guilty pleasures is food. Where would we be without food and wine and friends around the table? Where would we be?
Especially at the moment. Yeah. What are your pet peeves, or just a few things that drive you mad when you go out yourself to eat or drink?
Yeah, I think our staff sort of would leave it to their managers how much attention somebody wanted. Somebody needs loads of attention, and they're probably going to have problems the whole way through the meal anyway. I don't like to see waiters hovering around the table too long, but I don't like to see empty wine glasses. I encourage that people keep pouring the bottles of water. I try to insist that when someone's finished, you give them a dessert menu, that we need sales instead of a customer asking for that. But I don't like to see overselling or underselling, so it's getting that right balance, and we're quite good at that. Some people, you pour in the wine glass and 2 seconds later you're back and you're pouring it again. So sometimes you're not allowed to pour in the wine glasses anymore, by the way. You've got to leave the bottle on the table. So now it's hard.
Dangerous.
It's hard to gauge how much is left in the bottle, but yeah, no, that's it.
Well, listen, Michael, that brings us along to your last choice of music this evening. A lovely song, Luther Vandross, Dance With My Father.
Yeah, I always get quite emotional when I hear this record. My father has now passed, but a few years ago, they'd been probably 20 years ago, actually, they were married for about 20 years, and my father decided he wanted to go to America to make a country music record, with the help of the Reverend William McRae. So he wanted to go off to Nashville. He got on the plane to go to Nashville. And before he landed, my mother had passed. She died. And that's the first time I'd ever been apart in 25 years. And I always remember my wife Kate having to be on the phone, and we used to bring him back, and he got back and he found out she died. And he's still alive. He's 93 years old. But I just remember when I was a child, my mother just dancing in the middle of the floor, and my father just dancing around her. And when I heard the Luther song, it just reminds me of about families and how you keep families together. And you know, you might not have the future, but you have the memories. And it's just such a powerful song.
Wonderful. Well, Michael Dean, it has been an absolute pleasure chatting to you this evening, and thank you so much for coming on A Taste of Ireland.
Thank you. Thank you very much.